This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print in the July-August issue. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 13th in a series of interviews with security gurus. By popular demand, I'm pleased to have Ross Anderson in this episode of Silver Bullet. Ross has the distinction of having written the best security book of all time, Security Engineering. Hi, Ross.
Hi.
Ross is a professor of security engineering at Cambridge, where he leads the computer security group. Ross is also a well-known author and a consultant to industry. Some commercial organizations that I know of have a node in their threat model just for Ross, who tends to tell the truth about security and security apparatus. So you recently placed the entire contents of Security Engineering online for free. What's the response to that been like?
The response has been great. The last royalty check that I got from Wiley was satisfactorily up, and I've proved to my satisfaction and my publisher's satisfaction that the online book doesn't compete with the print edition.
Excellent.
It took me about a couple of years to convince them, but what was very helpful was that my colleague David Mackay's book on coding theory was put online 3 years ago by Cambridge University Press, mm-hmm. and that greatly helped his sales. So what seems to happen is that if you put your book online, people can find it easily, refer to it, and they say, hey, this is good, I want this on my shelf, and they go to Amazon and they click and they buy it.
That's great. I remember the day that you put it up, I sent an email around here and people had a hard time getting to it because the server was so bogged down. I think it's a very popular book you've got there.
Well, downloads of my book have, over the last year or so, been accounting for something like 5% of the computer lab's web traffic.
Wow.
So it remains popular.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I think it's an important book and one that everybody should read if they haven't read. So rush out and get yourself a copy or get yourself a web browser, as the case may be. Question for you with regard to security engineering and, in particular, software security. You know that's my bugaboo. Do you think we've been making progress in that field, in those fields, over the last decade?
There's been a little bit of progress in that you no longer get quite as many Stack Overflow vulnerabilities as there used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there are plenty others. And I believe that as software gets more and more complex, you're going to see an equilibrium which is determined more or less by sociocultural factors and economic factors rather than by the kind of tools that people have for vulnerability finding.
Right.
And so as we give people better tools, they'll just make more complex software. As we give them higher assurance systems, they'll take more risks with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're likely to end up in a world where there's a constant stream of vulnerabilities. And managing these becomes a very important process.
So does that kind of suggest that there's some sort of equilibrium point that we've already reached, that even though we're changing some factors, there's a dynamical system in play here?
Yes. Well, to take an example from the world of dependability and of software project management, for about the past 30 years, people who study large software projects have reckoned that about 30% of them fail, in that they don't work at all or they go wildly over budget and over time and so on and so forth. Now, since the 1970s, computer science community has made available to developers very, very much better tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we no longer program in Fortran and COBOL. We've got all sorts of mechanisms for managing large complex projects. And so what do people do? They build bigger and better disasters, right? But the 30% failure figure, and in fact a slightly higher failure figure in government, reflect underlying institutional realities.
Right, so it remains a constant.
They remain more or less constant. People are still selected for various jobs in companies and in government by their appetite for risk, by their technical ability, and by other factors. And one of the interesting things that we've been exploring recently is the question of why are large software project failures more common in government than in the private sector?
Got any intuitions on that one, or evidence?
Well, we're still collecting evidence. It's still at an anecdotal stage. But my first cut of an analysis of this comes from putting dependability economics alongside what we know about organizations, institutional economics, and public choice. And the pattern that emerges is this, that the sort of person you have to be a successful project manager, is miles different, is diametrically different from the sort of person you have to be a successful government minister or national leader.
Oh, very interesting.
You see, as a project manager, you have to start off by getting people to take all the hard decisions early, closing down all the options, and then to sit quiet and wait for 2 years while you code the thing and test it and ship it, and then make some hard, rapid decisions and compromises once you see how the thing behaves in the field. And all of this is completely anathema to a minister.
Right.
Because firstly, ministers, governments in general, aren't hard to do stuff. They are hard to mediate conflicts in society.
Mm-hmm.
And as most conflicts are bogus, an intelligent politician will flannel and put off decisions as long as he possibly can. Right? Because if you just stonewall people, most of them will go away within a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to take a decision and offend some segment of voters. And then again, if you're a minister, you've got to get your face in the press all the time. So you can't just sit quiet for 2 years while your system is built. You have
right.
to go out every month and publicly change the specification.
Now,
there's an awful lot more, but that gives you a flavor of how economic analysis is applied to institutions.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
You know, compared with economics of dependability,
yeah.
gives you an idea of why things go wrong.
Yeah, this whole economics and security thing that you've been helping to lead and found has really become quite a hot topic. Where do you think things currently stand in that subfield?
Well, we've got over 100 active researchers, and we have got two annual conferences now. The second one just started last year.
Oh, where's the second one? I know about the first.
That's the economics of infrastructure protection thing that Stuart Schechtel started on the East Coast.
Okay.
It was in November last year.
Okay.
But WICE, the workshop on economics and information security, is still the main event, and this year that's going to be at Carnegie Mellon in June.
Great. What's the most interesting non-obvious result from that work, you think?
Well, there have been many interesting and non-obvious results. The fundamental insight is that most systems fail not because of technical problems, but because incentives are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best paper, possibly the best paper at WICE last year, was one by Ben Edelman, where he pointed out that websites bearing the trustee certification mark were twice as likely as random similar websites to be malicious. And
that's a good one.
And
not surprising, really.
And this is an effect of adverse selection.
Uh-huh.
Good operators, people with an established corporate brand, don't bother with things like trustee.
Uh-huh.
Whereas all the shysters and hucksters and fly-by-night companies, they go and get that kite mark because it gives them some respectability that they think they need.
Sure. Yeah.
What's potentially enormously important to the online economy nowadays is another result that Ben puts in the same paper. Namely, if you look at the top-rated search items on Google for free search, and you compare them with the top-rated advertisement slot, the website in the top-rated advertisement is more than twice as likely to be a scamster site as the top-rated free search site.
Hmm.
And obviously for exactly the same reason,
yep.
scamsters buy adverts.
Right. Yep.
Now, Ben's conclusion there was, don't click on ads.
That's a good one.
If everybody in the online world had read this paper and thought about it carefully, then Google would be in bankruptcy tomorrow.
Well, I think they've diversified past just online ads, but you're right, it would certainly affect their revenue stream.
So these results are enormously important for business
yep.
As a whole, as well as being very important, of course, for security engineers, software developments, developers, and the industry as a whole.
Sure, yeah. You've pointed out, I think, many times the problem, the imbalance between victims, say somebody who has to use Microsoft Office and then their machine falls prey to a malicious code attack, and those who are building or could mitigate the problem, like Microsoft. And so what is a good way to try to address that imbalance? Are there economic tools to do that with?
Well, in theory, if you look at the theory of tort, a risk should lie with the party that's best able to mitigate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that it should be Microsoft's job to see to it that their software ships in as close to an unhackable form as they can get it.
And to some extent, you might say that the invisible hand of the market, you know, pulling an Adam Smith metaphor, has caused Microsoft to at least change their behavior in some ways.
There has been a significant amount of pressure on them, but Microsoft's pretty well a monopoly because of the network effects that you get with platforms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very well for guys like me to escape their clutches. I use a Linux box in the lab, and I've got a Mac, which I carry around with me as a laptop.
Yeah, me too.
But for the average person, there isn't a practical alternative to using Windows. And this means that they just basically have to put up with what Redmond ships to them.
Right.
It happens not just as an issue in technology platform markets, but also in financial markets. For example, in Europe, customers have got very much poorer protection against online banking scams of every kind, you know, from cloned ATM cards to phishing scams,
mm-hmm.
than is the case in the USA. And it's interesting to see that many of the new e-money providers, you know, the non-bank payment services companies,
like PayPal and the like,
are operating essentially under European rules rather than under American rules.
Hmm.
Now, at present, PayPal are very scrupulous at repaying every one of their customers who's the victim of a scam.
Mm-hmm.
But their terms and conditions do rather appoint them as the judge and jury in this, and go as far as they can to ruling out any independent regulation. So in that respect, they're falling inside the European camp.
Hmm.
And I predict that there's going to be some potentially quite serious tension in this, which will involve not just computer security per se, but banking regulators, the anti-money laundering crowd, FinCEN, FBI, comparable agencies here, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because phishing is one of the biggest growing threats on the internet.
Yeah, absolutely.
And technical mechanisms alone aren't going to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think the banking industry is in for an interesting wake-up call anyway over on that side of the pond, just because the consolidation that you're benefiting from over there has caused people to make lots more money, but the U.S. banks aren't over there competing yet. It's going to be interesting when that happens.
Well, even within Europe, we find that the banking markets are balkanized, and although most countries in Europe now use the same currency, it's extraordinarily tiresome to make payments, say, between Portugal and Belgium.
Right.
Now, the current harmonization of banking law in Europe is aimed at making that cheaper and easier over a 5 to 10 year horizon by making systems interoperable.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's also having the effect of leveling down consumer protections.
So one of the things that I love about your work is your no-nonsense approach to telling it like it is when it comes to attacks. I've sort of tried to emulate that in some of my own work, especially exploiting software. But presumably, you find the act of describing attacks and security failures essential to good engineering.
Well, absolutely. Civil engineers learn far more from the bridges that fall down than from the very much greater number of bridges that stay up.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, if somebody's going to call themselves a security engineer, then they really have to study how things fail. That means that they, you know, have to read the press, read the mailing lists, read comp.risks, plug into all the various sources of information about the bad things that are going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose that this notion of gag orders to stifle discussion of security apparatus, I find that misguided and unethical, and I know that you do too.
Well, I was a victim of this a few years ago when a certain large bank got an order against me,
mm-hmm.
In the High Court in London when I was appearing as an expert witness case in some disputed ATM withdrawals from one of their accounts.
That was Citibank, right?
Indeed, and there's currently an application before a judge in Berlin asking that judge to order Citibank to raise the gag order so that I can testify in a Citibank case in Berlin. So, you know, this has all sorts of unpleasant spillover effects.
Mm-hmm.
On a larger scale, we're seeing a tendency in a number of countries, including, unfortunately, Britain, to pass laws criminalizing the manufacture, possession or use of hacking tools.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now causing problems for some people in the UK who are running computer security courses.
Yeah.
It's created sufficient legal uncertainty that their university's lawyers are saying, no, you can't have your students doing, you know, key search or Wi-Fi hacking or whatever experiments, you know.
So we'll end up with a bunch of dumb people who are supposed to defend against these attacks.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, the law is not particularly well drafted, and the Home Office say that they didn't mean it to stop research, etc. But the mere fact of it being obscure, and the mere fact of, you know, corporate bureaucracies in universities as elsewhere being risk averse, is beginning to cause a problem in some places.
Do you think that what was done to adjust the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has other problems other than the one we're speaking of, but it was adjusted to allow security researchers to look at security apparatus, do you think that that sort of adjustment is sufficient?
I don't know, because I don't work in USA. I haven't followed that particularly closely. It was something I saw out of the corner of my eye, no more than that.
Yeah.
But certainly we need the space to do our jobs. Another problem that's coming up in the UK and Europe is in attempts to license security personnel. We had a law introduced in Britain a few years ago that enables the government by regulation to license security people. And this was brought in initially to stop organized criminals supplying bouncers for pubs and clubs. But once the law is there, the officials who operate it get into empire-building mode.
Right.
And there's currently some mutterings about compulsory registration for security consultants.
Wow, interesting. That's not been seen over this side of the pond.
And given that security consultants are such an enormously broad church, you know, ranging from all system administrators at one end to at the other end, specialists like the people who sweep 10 Downing Street for bugs.
Right.
You know, there are dozens of different communities, each with their own cultures. You know, the computer culture, the sysadmin culture, is generally, like much of the computer culture, relatively libertarian and West Coast based. Whereas security specialists who've come out of an army background think that regulation is just fine, because it helps to keep down the competition. So it's a very inappropriate measure that's trying to force an awful lot of little specialized sub-industries into one straitjacket. And it's something that you should fight as hard as you possibly can if some misguided congressman tries to introduce it on your side of the pond.
Oh, we'll keep our eye out for that one. Switching gears a little bit, why do you suppose that the same old attacks keep on applying over and over and over again? I used to think, you know, we were discovering new things 10 years ago when I was writing my first stuff in computer security, and now I discover that, lo and behold, these problems have been known for at least three decades, most of them. In particular, I'm thinking of your man in the middle, or I like to call it attacker in the middle to make it a little less sexist, work on RFID systems. You know, how can we teach builders to know about these attacks and these attack patterns?
Well, I don't really think that you can, unfortunately. Man in the middle person, whatever attacks, have been around since at least the time when Walsingham doctored a letter from Mary, Queen of Scots, to her supporters.
Right, which was quite a while ago.
You know, which was about 16th century, adding a few extra cipher groups, which basically instructed her supporters to send her an enciphered list of all their supporters, which basically disclosed the whole conspiracy to the hangman's noose. Knowledge of this is becoming widespread, I think, thanks to phishing. But people tend to think, you know, it doesn't apply to me.
Right.
And you have got the unfortunate deployment of a whole lot of applications on RFID just at the same time that the mobile phone industry is working hard to put 500 million attack platforms out there in people's pockets. I'm referring to mobile phones with NFC capability.
Right.
So an NFC phone with appropriate software can act as an RFID tag and also as a reader. So it can be a pseudo server to one client and a pseudo client to another server, and the two can communicate by GPRS. Now, you could not have engineered a better platform for middle person attacks if you had set out to do it. And the fact that they made it into a huge business model is just amazing.
Yeah.
So a whole lot of people who rely on RFID for low-value payments, for road toll tags, for prisoner tagging, for keeping hooligans out of football grounds, and so on and so forth, are going to find that the systems are spoofed.
Right.
And we've had quite some fun thinking of all the applications that people can get up to.
I bet you did, and I bet you wrote it down, too.
If you look at my website, you'll see that there's a paper up there, which is a summary of the talk that I gave at Financial Crypto last month.
That's great.
For example, bad people who at present go through subway trains mugging people won't have to carry knives in future. They just carry an NFC phone, and as they walk past everybody, they just go ching, 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 and take £9.99 out of their electronic purses. The ruler of Korea wanted to do a denial-of-service attack against the French, for example. If he decided he didn't like the Parisians, he could just get one of his satellites to collect €9.95 from every Frenchman by, you know, sending the appropriate signals from orbit. The potential for mischief is quite mind-blowing. What this means in practice is that a whole lot of systems are going to have to be re-engineered.
Exactly, yep.
And that's going to cost a lot of money.
Right. Well, for a final topic, which has nothing to do with our previous conversation so far, you and I have both done our share of busking in the world, me with a fiddle and you on your bagpipes.
Uh-huh.
And that photo of you when you were busking at 20 years or so old in Germany is fantastic. But the question I have for you is, which tartan is that you're wearing?
Oh, that's the Anderson tartan.
Gotcha. And which version, the ancient hunting Anderson looks like?
That's the ancient Anderson, yeah.
Yeah, I have the ancient McGraw hunting tartan for my own kilt.
Uh-huh.
It's nice to speak to somebody who has a kilt.
Hey.
Well, thanks a lot for your time, Ross. Really appreciate it.
Not at all, Gary. It's good to speak to you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P Magazine will feature a print version of this interview. Fittingly, that issue will have a cryptography theme with a focus on portable devices and IP protection. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.